Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, guys, good morning. It's, where are we? Friday, the 5th of February, 2010. That makes this Solder Smoke 121. Sorry for the long delay. I'll tell you why in a minute. It's a sad story. Technical woes. First, a little Italian travelogue. Haven't been doing too much traveling. Been going out to the country house in the Sabine Hills. We did that quite a bit during January. The winter's kind of getting to us, though, so this weekend we're back in Rome. Had a lot of fun out there, and we're not too far from the snow line. Just about a half hour beyond our the place where we have the country place, there's you start getting up high enough where there's snow. So a couple weeks ago, we took the kids up to a little ski resort, still in the region of Lazio, which is Rome's region. So not too far from Rome, but a place called Terminillo, and a really nice little ski resort. We don't really ski. I've never been into it. My wife is from the sunny Caribbean, so the whole ski thing just strikes her as extremely weird and uncomfortable. So not really into skiing, but the kids are into the sleigh riding. So we went up there and rented a couple little sleds and let them slide down the hill for a few hours. It's really beautiful. That's one of the real nice things about Italy. You've got such a diverse geography. Actually, from Rome, I think I might have mentioned earlier that there are places where you can get into the snow in even a shorter amount of time. Just there's a place called Campo Felice that is just about 1 hour from Rome if traffic is good, and there you're in the snow. So we're up in the Apennine Mountains, the central mountain chain that runs up and down the kind of the spine of Italy, and really beautiful place. And so had a lot of fun up there in the snow. Then it was back to the country house, where I've been playing with the radios and telescopes and having a good old time. Listen, I want to back up a little bit and thank somebody that I forgot to thank. On New Year's Eve, actually, I got a really nice email and picture from Thomas, N5RTF. And Thomas sent New Year's greetings along with a very original solder cake. You know, we got solder smoke, we got solder news, we got solder photos and everything else. We got a solder cake from N5RTF. It involved, I think, some 200 rolls of 6040 rosin core solder, arranged in a very festive manner, and placed in the form of a cake with a nice, I think he had an LED light on the top for the candle. It was all very appropriate, and he sent along a really funny message about how this all started. He said he wasn't quite sure how he came to be the owner of 200 rolls of 6040 rosin core solder, but he said he felt that it had something to do with alcohol and eBay. So, anyway, well, we're glad you have all that solder, Thomas, because when the government comes and it tries to take away our soldering irons and make us use lead-free solder and all that kind of stuff, we're all going to turn to you. So thanks for sending that along, and thanks for creating the official Solder Smoke lead-filled solder reserve. Thanks very much. I mentioned technical troubles, technical woes, and we've certainly had them here, guys. It's been ugly. I have to take a sip of coffee before I even start talking about it. It's been so painful. Mostly in the computer area. Yeah, mostly computers. The radios haven't really been giving me too much trouble. The only one I've really been using is the HW8. And aside from a loss of a mysterious death of Q11 in HW8 in the HW8 a couple of years ago, it's been trouble-free. I've got the little station up there. It runs solar power off a 12-volt 7-amp-hour jail cell. Got it charging up with the Volkswagen solar panel, using my Trastevere flea market antenna tuner. Having a lot of fun with it. Radios, not the problem, but computers, the computers came after me. I think sometimes if you're having good luck with the radios, the whatever deity that controls the computer wants to take revenge, and it certainly took revenge on me over the last couple of weeks. You know, we're not really on the cutting edge of computer science here at Solder Smoke HQ. You guys have probably picked up on this, and I've started calling our setup here roadkill computing. For the longest time here, I was using a really ancient, clunky, bulky CRT monitor that I literally found on the mean streets of South Kensington in London. I was walking along, and one of our way too rich neighbors in that neighborhood had decided, you know, out with the old and in with the new, and had placed a perfectly good monitor out on the curb. So, of course, I scooped it up, took it home, and have been using it ever since. But it gave up the ghost. And actually, this was the second monitor. I had two of these old CRT monitors, and within a month, both of them went toes up. So this was really bad because I was using the ancient monitor with the almost equally, probably more ancient Dell computer that I'm using now to record this issue of Solder Smoke. The Dell, I guess it's some ancient version of Pentium. It's running the operating system. I'm embarrassed to say it's Windows 2000, and but it seems to do the trick, and it doesn't give me too much trouble. And I've got everything set up for Solder Smoke, so I wanted to continue to operate with that. The other computer I've been working on is a laptop that I have here that my friend Jorge has been helping me out with quite a bit. It's running Linux Ubuntu. We've discussed this. We'll talk about it some more too. And you know, right around the time that the two monitors went dead, the wouldn't you know it, my one remaining computer, the Tekra 8100, started giving me trouble too. And you know, this is enough to really get a guy discouraged. But anyway, Jorge helped me out some more. As for the old monitors, I decided it was time for a new one. Not a new old one, a new flat screen LCD monitor. So I ordered one through Amazon. It's a real simple little Acer 17-inch monitor. Cost $100. Arrived here in a week, and I'm looking at it right now, and it's just beautiful. I also bought one of these little monitor switches. There it goes, switching back and forth. The idea is I've got two old clunker computers. The hated EPC computer down there that the kids like to use to watch videos on and stuff. So one monitor, I got the switch, can switch them back and forth. Gonna hook that up today. Gentlemen, we're moving into the modern world, and it's a lot of fun. It's great to have the computers back in operation. The Linux machine now is working beautifully, and I take back most of the bad things I've said and or will soon say about Linux. Gradually we're getting back in business computer-wise here. Yeah, getting rid of the CRTs, it's really good because the shack is so small, and they were so big, they were actually in the summertime really heating up the shack considerably. So for global warming and shack warming purposes, good riddance to the CRT. On the laptop, the problems there, well, I'm not quite sure. The problems may have been, may have had something to do with the hard drive that was going bad. I think that was part of it. But also, you know, when you get when you get problems with a computer, if you have another one working, and I, at one point I was using Billy's little Asus netbook, you know, the little tiny, you know, little tiny computer. What's it called? Yeah, the Asus. It's just a webbook or a netbook. Man, those things are just too small. They may be good for the kids. Billy likes it, but if you start trying to use this thing regularly with that tiny little screen and the little tiny keypad, it's you're getting close to BlackBerry territory here, guys. So I was real happy to get the Tekra 8100 going. I think what went wrong with the Tekra 8100 really was a loose connection. This was, of course, very satisfying for a NAC victim. I used Billy's little computer and went out onto the web and found that the symptoms I had, which were basically the computer would from time to time just freeze up on me, and it seemed to be related to moving it. If I bumped the computer, if I bumped the table, the whole thing would freeze up. Of course, this is not good. And but I went out onto the web and I came across a forum in which they were talking about these computers, and one guy noted that they had a tendency to have internal connections come loose, and this could create a dreaded intermittent problem. So I decided to crack open the toolbox and crack open the laptop, and man, I pulled this thing apart. There must have been 25 screws holding it together, and I pulled out all of them, and I had this thing spread out all over the workbench. And at one point I said, oh man, I'm never going to get this thing back together. I mean, this is a long way from a Drake 2B. But I kind of hung in there. I kept my fingers crossed. I pulled out all the connectors that could come out. I sprayed them all with contact cleaner. There you go, contact cleaner. Not WD-40, real electrical contact cleaner. And I reseated everything. I made sure everything was tightened up. Popped in a new hard drive, and then reloaded Ubuntu. And I have the Ubuntu disk and reloaded it. Takes a while, but man, it was worth the wait, because this thing is really humming now. It's fast. The screen is nice. It's nice and light and portable. And I'm going to soon be firing it up with Whisper, but it was really fun to clean it. You know, I don't know, this is a kind of a soul in the machine thing. We always talk about soul in the new machine by that book by Tracy Kidder, in which he describes the one of the first kind of mini mainframe computers. But I always think that, you know, when you take something like a laptop that can be, you know, that, let's face it, it's really an appliance, but when you crack it open and you work on it a little bit, even if it's something as simple as tightening up connections and spraying in some contact cleaner, it makes the machine a little bit less of an appliance and more fully a part of the Radio Shack. So I was pleased to do that. And anyway, I thought for a while that this might be the first ever Linux-based solder smoke episode, because I got the Tekra 8100 going before the replacement monitor came in, and I was about ready to go out and try to fire up Audacity and the several other bits of software that I need to produce a solder smoke episode, but cooler heads prevailed, or anyway, my head got cooler, because I realized that this would be another tale of woe. And fortunately, the new monitor for the PC came in, and I got that going. So now, this is not a Linux produced solder smoke episode. This one is being brought to you by the good folks at Microsoft Windows 2000. All right, let's see what else. Now, I guess continuing our tale of woe theme, which will, I think, soon descend into real curmudgeonism. I must report no further progress on my soft rock SDR transceiver. You know, I was struggling to maintain my kind of enthusiasm for this project, and I am enthused about it. I'm going to go back to it. Don't get me wrong. It's just that sometimes, as a home brewer, discretion is the better part of valor, and you have to decide, okay, right now, this is not the good thing for me to work on. So with all these computer problems swirling around me here in the shack, I knew that confronting the Surface Mount software-defined radio world was not a good move at this point. So I put it aside. I will go back to it later. For now, and I say this is a temporary thing because I will go back to it, but I sometimes find myself wondering if Surface Mount soldering and software-defined radio just might not be for me. That might be the case. I haven't really arrived at that conclusion, but it might be that I am just I'm just more attuned towards or more kind of suited for old radio lead components and hardware-defined radio. I think that might be it. I mean, I got on Echolink recently because that's one of my one of the things I want to do here in 2010 is get into some more Echolink QSOs. And I talked to a couple of old friends that I hadn't talked to in a long time. Nigel ZL2SEA down there in New Zealand, and I had a nice talk. And then I ran into a guy I hadn't talked to in a real long time, Phil, VK6ADF, out there in Perth in Western Australia. Phil and I had a nice conversation. He's into kites, and we have a number of other common interests. And anyway, we started talking about these kinds of technical themes. Now, Phil, I think, also was born in the International Geophysical Year. He's another IGY guy, and I think our attitude towards some of these newfangled technical developments has something to do with that whole IGY thing. Because our conversation on Echolink became sort of, I would guess you could call it a celebration of Luddite curmudgeonism. Yeah, let's be honest. Because we just went through and we decided that neither of us liked surface mount soldering. I think we decided that we weren't too crazy about software-defined radios. And then by the end, we were also bad-mouthing, I mean seriously bad-mouthing, Linux and the operating system, and pretty much all people who use it or talk about it on the internet. yeah, that was it. And so we knew, and as we were doing this, you know, at least we're self-aware. We're conscious of the fact that we are engaged in Luddite curmudgeonism. And you know, I found myself, you know, if when you look back into the really early days of ham radio, when CW came along, when continuous wave Morse came along, I mean, we associate CW with Morse, but you got to remember that Morse was around a long time before radio. And even within radio, even when they were using radio, they were, for a long time, they were using Morse, but it wasn't CW. You radio historians know what I'm talking about here. We're talking about Spark. And for the first couple of decades of radio, the majority of radio amateurs were running Spark rigs. And the waves were, well, far from continuous. Anyway, when CW came along, it had really obvious technical advantages. But our radio ancestors back there, many of them wanted no part of this newfangled CW thing, and you can see that reflected in QSL cards from that era. very often you'll hear, you'll see a kind of bold and defiant "Spark Forever" emblazoned on the top of the QSL card. You know, talk about, you know, fighting against the tide there. Holy cow, "Spark Forever." But that was the attitude. You know, and we're an interesting group, radio amateurs, because we embrace technology. Obviously, that's what brings us to the hobby, I think, an interest in technology. But at the same time, we become very wedded to the technology that we've been using and very resistant to kind of change and innovation. There's a lot of real irony there. And, you know, it happened also when SSB came along, you know, and a lot of guys just refused to get into, a lot of guys still call it single slot bucket, right? You know, and so... And they stick with AM. So anyway, I'm aware that I have to watch out for these Luddite curmudgeon tendencies. But anyway, when Phil and I were on Echolink, we were really wallowing in it. You know, and I noted to him, I said, you know, the surface mount soldering, it just, I mean, there are things about it that are just really kind of alien to me. I mean, the fact that using the microscopes, having a special microscope so that you could see what you're working on, that's okay. But using essentially a version of a hairdryer to melt the solder with the components, or even worse, using a little oven. One guy wrote in and described how what he does is he arranges all of the surface mount components on the board. I guess they're held down with a bit of flux, but the solder is on the pads, and he gets everything lined up nice and neat, and he pops it into a little oven and turns up the heat, and then all of a sudden the solder reaches the melting point, and presto, all the components drop down, I guess, a few microns and into place. You turn off the oven, the solder cools, and you're done. You know, the image that came to mind when I have three younger sisters. And they were always playing with this toy. My fellow IGY guys out there will probably remember this, the Easy Bake Oven. It was a little toy oven, and you popped it open. And when our listener was describing this oven-based soldering technique, I kept thinking about the Easy Bake Oven, and I was thinking, man, give me my Weller soldering gun. With a two-position trigger, you know, so I can just pull that thing full on and, you know, go with a, what is it, 150 watts or whatever it was, and really solder. All right. So enough of the Luddite curmudgeonism. You know, there's a whole other set of technical woes that we were suffering since I last transmitted a solder smoke, and this has to do with another technically difficult and often frustrating hobby that I'm now involved in. You know, I don't know if you guys have ever had this moment, but I can remember as a kid when I was struggling with some really daunting technical problem. I mean, I think I was trying to suppress some harmonics that were coming out of my DX40 transmitter. Or something really difficult, or the thing wasn't working and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with it. I found myself at one point just sort of throwing up my hands and wondering why I had ever got into this crazy avocation. I was thinking, man, why couldn't I have gone with stamp collecting? Stamp collectors don't have these kind of frustrations. I mean, the stamps don't suddenly mysteriously stop working. They're there. But no, I had to be in ham radio with these weird rigs that very few people knew about. Anyway, this was, and of course, before the internet, before you could turn to the web and ask for help from around the world, as you can now. Okay, now I find myself getting into another, I'm discovering, really frustrating hobby, and that's this is partially. Well, it's mostly my fault, but I guess it's partially Billy's fault because it was his idea. This is the fascinating world of radio-controlled airplanes. You know, I guess I'm the victim of a number of places we've lived. These guys have been flying the planes around, and you go by and you park the car, and they look like they're having so much fun. It looks like a lot of fun. You're flying the plane around. There's a radio element in it. I think a lot of us are interested in airplanes and aviation. I certainly am. So it all seemed to come together naturally. And at Christmas time, I think I told you, I bought one of these little supposedly trainer airplanes, little styrofoam wing plane. You didn't actually have to build it, because I knew that that was a real invitation to technical heartbreak. But hey, this thing looked fairly simple. They promised it to be a real kind of easy learning experience. They even said they had a CD that they gave you that would teach you how to fly the plane, and they promised that it had this special technology in the radio system called ACT, anti-crash technology. Doesn't that sound good? They even have a little switch up on top of the control box. ACT on or ACT off? Who would ever turn ACT off? What, it's almost like saying, I want to crash the airplane, right? Well, anyway, Billy and I took the plane. We put it together. Very easy to assemble, of course. And we took it out to the big field near the country house, which we immediately named Chingali International Airport, for reasons that longtime listeners will understand. And, you know, with the occasional shotgun blasts going off in the background as people continued to hunt Chingali, Billy and I started throwing this styrofoam device up into the air. It's from a company called Hobby Sport. And let me see, what's the name of the bird? Oh, it's called the... from Hobby Sport, it's called the Firebird Freedom. Seems to be kind of a patriotic theme there to the airplane for some reason. The Firebird Freedom. And we watched the CD and we read all the instructions. We talked to a few people. And we started throwing it up into the air. And it would crash. And it would crash again. And then bits would start to fall off of it. Then we would take it back to the house and patch it together. Then we'd go out to the field. And then I would crash it a couple times. And then Billy would crash it a couple times. And let me tell you, this thing, this hobby, makes my early frustrating experiences with amateur radio technical difficulties seem like a walk in the park. At least with the radio will occasionally release some smoke, but it's still sitting there. It'll rarely go on fire. But when you mess up with one of these radio-controlled airplanes, the thing just goes into a nosedive, and it hits the ground with this really disheartening thud. And you see the wings fall off. And the worst thing is if friends and relatives have come to watch you fly the airplane. Oh, my God. You know, they're standing there. And then they start kibitzing. Why don't you do this? Why don't you make it turn left? Turn off the engine. Turn on the engine. Oh, no, don't do it that way. Oh, my gosh. You know, it's just not good. But we got a lot of... We got some good pointers. And I think we're going to take a little break, but then we're going to go back at it. I've got to order some replacement parts. I've learned from the some of the radio controlled airplane fora that this particular model might have some nasty stall characteristics in the wing. The nasty characteristic being that the wings don't stall at the same time. It does this thing called tip stall, where one stalls, and then it kind of flips the plane over, and then it goes into the nosedive described earlier. So we might also order an even simpler plane and heed the advice of the many people who've written in. We'll get it. We'll get it going eventually. We've got the we'll fly the plane there out there at Chingali International. But for now, we're gonna take a little bit of a break. Let's see what else. There have been some uplifting and positive developments. It's not all been, you know, heartache and woe. In the area of astronomy, you know, I am an amateur astronomer, and I try as hard as I can to make this this other hobby? Because this one is not one that causes frustration and heartache. My wife, Elisa, tells me that astronomy has a good effect on me. She said that every time I engage in astronomy, every time I take the telescope out and look at the stars, I come back a little bit more tranquilo, a little bit more tranquil. So, I guess astronomy could be an antidote for this kind of hobby frustration. And we certainly have had good luck with astronomy in the last month or so. Because, gentlemen, Mars is in opposition. If you want to know what that means, just you could take a look on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. Scroll down. I've got a couple articles about Mars and being in opposition. And in this case, picture's worth a thousand words. Because it really, one diagram there makes you understand why this is a particularly good time to look at Mars. So we had the 6-inch Dobsonian Newtonian telescope out in the right there at Chingali International Airport, and we're looking at Mars over the course of several weekends in January. Mars reached full opposition on January 27th. It's not a particularly good opposition because the planet is relatively far away from us, but it's springtime in the northern hemisphere of Mars, and the northern polar cap is really big, having just come out of a full winter, and man, you can see it in my little telescope. Mars is not the easiest object with a small telescope. I mean, Jupiter and Saturn are much more spectacular. But when Mars is in opposition like this, even with a little 6-inch scope, you can start to see surface features on Mars. You can see that northern polar cap. You can see some of the dark areas that Percival Lowell thought were canals. And it's really a hoot. You have to wait. You have to look at it for a while. You have to wait till the air gets steady, and then you get a glimpse of these things. But the thought that I was sitting there in this olive grove north of Rome in the Sabine Hills, looking directly at the northern polar ice cap of Mars, I thought that was really, really neat. I had a good time with that. And then we looked at another object, one of my favorite objects, and I used to look. I don't think I've seen this since the Dominican Republic. I was in the Dominican Republic from 92 to 96, and it was there that I got my first view, both naked eye with binoculars and with a telescope, of the Andromeda Galaxy M31. Andromeda Galaxy is a really interesting thing to see. It's the furthest object that you can see with the naked eye. It's really out there. It's at 2.5 million light years. I made a mistake on the blog and I put billion. I guess I was getting into the Carl Sagan billions and billions mode. But it's two, and a reader wrote in and corrected me, so thanks for that. But it's 2.5 million light years, more or less. That means the photons that we were looking at began their trip long before there were human beings on the planet. And we could, even with kind of far from optimal skies out there in the Sabine Hills, Billy and I could make it out naked eye. You have to know where to look, of course, and you have to do a little bit of what they call averted vision. And I taught Billy about averted vision this time. He thought that was really neat. You know, that basically the trick is, if you want to look at something, your eyes can pick it up better if you look a little bit off to the side. It's an astronomy trick. And used in averted vision, we were able to spot the little cloud that is the Andromeda Galaxy. And then I was able to get the telescope on it. And with a 6-inch scope, I mean, it doesn't look anything like the really spectacular galaxy pictures that you see in the astronomy books. But it's very gratifying to know that you're looking at it with your own telescope, and that, you know, you're seeing it directly, and you could make out the elongated shape of the galaxy, and just really awesome to sit there, in the true sense of the word, to sit there and contemplate something that far away, completely outside of our galaxy. So, you know, good to look at something very close, Mars, and good to look at something very far away, Andromeda. We had looked at a number of other objects. So we looked at the North America Nebula in Orion's belt, very appropriate because we were out there with Canadian friends, so appropriate that we look at the North America Nebula. And I have a bunch of articles about all this astronomy stuff on the blog at soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Even got to do a little kind of hands-on work on the telescope, guys. You'll like this. You know, the a Dobsonian telescope, it's named for one of the gurus, I guess in his case, literally a guru of astronomy, the former monk John Dobson out there in California. He was the one who came up with real simple telescopes. He came up with the idea of sidewalk astronomy, taking your telescope out and letting passersby use it. And his idea was that you needed a very simple mount. So he built this mount that basically does away with all the fancy equatorial mount mechanisms and weights and all that kind of stuff. And it takes the telescope tube, basically puts it on top of what we'd call a lazy Susan, and then comes up with a kind of a pivot mount. The whole thing, the telescope and the mount are connected. They kind of float together on these little Teflon pads. I was finding that my Teflon pads were getting a bit sticky. And it was, and as I tried to move the telescope to follow Mars as the Earth turned, it was kind of sticky. It was just not quite smooth. And I knew I needed a little bit of lubricant there. My first instincts, of course, were, as you'd expect, WD-40. Anytime something starts sticking, you start looking around for the liquid that that my friend John, EI-7BA, has very eloquently dubbed the Pope's pee. I started looking for the WD-40 around. So I'm thinking, man, what am I going to do? What can I use to oil this thing? And I realized that I was completely surrounded by the answer. I'm sitting there in an olive grove, wondering what kind of oil I'm going to use to oil the telescope in the olive grove. Well, the answer came to me, of course, and the answer, olive oil. So I went into the kitchen and found a very nice bottle of Sabina olive oil, a picture of which is on the blog if you guys are interested in this. And as they said in the old Brill Cream commercial, a little dab will do you. And I just took a little dab of that olive oil, put it on the Teflon pads, and man, that telescope was spinning smoothly. So again, that you get that satisfaction that you get from fixing or improving something on your own, using kind of locally procured parts and expertise. I hope that I'm not going to hear from listeners that it's a well-known fact that olive oil causes Teflon to melt or leaves, you know, a glue-like residue that destroys the telescope. But I don't think so. I think that somehow it was very appropriate to use olive oil on the Newtonian Dobsonian 6-inch reflector. Another kind of interesting astronomical thing, and I have this up on the blog. You know, we're very interested in violins here. Both kids play the violins. And I think I'm going to have them come in here and play you guys. I'm going to force you guys to listen to a little bit of my kids playing violins. But I've been reading about the Italian violin maker Stradivari. I have an article about this up on the blog. And they've always been wondering, what is it about Stradivari's violins that, you know, 300, 350 years, is it that far? Yeah, 300 or so years after he made them, they're better than ever, and they're superior to anything that could be produced even in the most modern laboratories and factories, places where you'd think they'd be able to produce an exact copy of a Stradivari violin, but apparently they can't. There's no substitute for the old gear. I guess the violin boat anchors, that, as we'd say. One of the theories that has come up is that Stradivari was using wood that was grown during a period called the Maunder Minimum, when there was a sunspot minimum. And apparently this had an effect on tree growth. And the theory is, and it's just a theory, was that maybe because of this particular tree growth pattern, maybe Stradivari had some wood that was particularly good for violin making. It sounds good. I'm not quite sure if it's true, but it's good because it creates a connection, you see, between astronomy, violins, and sunspots, and thus amateur radio. So it all comes together. That's what we do here at Solder Smoke. We take these seemingly unconnected things and somehow make them related to amateur radio. Right? I got an article. This here, we need to get serious here sometimes, guys. We need to actually talk about some serious technical topics because we ramble on quite a bit. I got a nice email. I get great emails about the Solder Smoke book. I think, you know, Solder Smoke, the book, let's face it, it's never going to be a bestseller. It's never going to be on Oprah. Oprah is never going to talk about Solder Smoke, the book. I mean, I suppose if it was about Solder Smoke, the book, and how it made my thighs skinnier, then maybe we'd have a shot at it. Or if it was like Oprah, Solder Smoke, the book, and how I overcame my horrendous personal problems, then maybe then we'd have a shot at Oprah. But as it is, you know, Solder Smoke, the book, and how mixers really work, no. Oprah and the New York Times bestseller list are just not interested. But I think we're setting something of a record. I think the record is the percentage of readers who actually send in an email about the book. I think we're running right now somewhere around 20%, which I think is pretty good feedback. Everybody seems to like it. And I get really interesting messages from readers who want to follow up or discuss or add something. I also really appreciate all the helpful suggestions that people have been offering. One of the really nice emails I got came in about the role of mathematics in electronics and to what extent mathematics offers a path to true understanding of electronic circuits. You know, very often as we try to understand how different circuits really work, and I mean really work, for example, mixers, very often we're just given the mathematical formula that describe how the circuit operates. In the case of the mixers, it's trig formulas involving multiplication of sine waves or cosine waves. And yeah, we know that the math shows that the mixing occurs, and the math explains or demonstrates that some and different frequencies will be generated. But my feeling has always been that that's not quite enough. It's not just enough to know that. You kind of have to go at it and seek kind of a deeper level of understanding. And I'm not being anti-math here, but I note in a Solder Smoke, in a Blogspot, SolderSmokeBlogspot.com article, that Howard Armstrong, the inventor of the regen and the superhet, seemed to have similar in his gut feelings about the need for kind of intuitive understanding. So check it out. You guys might find it interesting. There's been some interesting comments on that particular article, and it's up there on the Blogspot page. All right, so now we're moving away from the tales of technical woe. Astronomy, I guess, is away from that. It's positive. And continuing with that, there's been a lot of positive, uplifting news coming in over the wires to my email box and to the Solder Smoke blog. One of the stories that's really uplifting and I found really inspirational is the story of one of our fellow radio amateurs, QRP enthusiast, and home brewer, kit builder, Jack Dunnigan. Jack wrote to me before, I guess a few months ago, maybe half a year or so ago, about his impending move to Africa. And he talked about getting a whisper station going or a beacon station going there. And I tried to be helpful, but I don't think I gave Jack, well, I wish I'd given Jack more helpful advice. It was just a busy time, but I'm glad to report that he's off to a great start, and he's now active and on the air from Masaka, Uganda, and his call sign is 5X7JD. What a wonderful call sign. And he's got a really great blog up. I have a link to it on the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. And Jack's blog is inspirational at two levels. I think the most important one is the good work that he's doing to help people in Africa, in Uganda. He's working with an organization that helps thousands of kids who are living with AIDS, and they run homes for these kids and care for them, and it's obviously a really great organization, and it's just wonderful that good people like Jack and his wife are willing to go out into difficult areas and be far from home and help people who really need help. So three cheers to you, Jack, and to your wife, and good luck in Masaka. It's also inspirational because of the radio story that he tells, and he talks about putting a tuna tin 2 on the air from Masaka, Uganda, and he wants to get it into beacon mode. But there's a lot of discussion on his blog about the rig. I think this is one from, is it from W1REX? I see that characteristic main label there on the picture. I think that's from, he may have been the person who supplied the kit for the tuna tin 2 in Uganda. So there it is. Jack's story reminded me of his story of going out and helping people in need made me think of what was going on here in the last month, and that's the Haiti situation. What a terrible, terrible thing that is. And you know, we have real connections to that island. My wife, that's my wife's home island. She's from the Dominican Republic, which is the eastern two-thirds of the island, and Haiti is always, you know, Haiti and people from Haiti are always around you when you live in the DR. I made it over to Port-au-Prince and once during my tour there, and so I'm familiar with the city, so it's really, really painful to see it the way it is now. I mean, it was always a difficult place and always a place with a lot of suffering, but it's just got unimaginably worse. And so I was really pleased to see that radio amateurs are doing their bit and helping out with relief efforts in Haiti, and three cheers for them. All right, more inspirational stuff. This from the hero of the Hobbit Hole, the poet laureate of QRP, the Wizard of Vermont, Michael Rainey, AA1TJ. Really great stuff. Mike continues to push the envelope of simple kind of new uses for very simple components, and I was really amazed to see him reporting the use of an all diode receiver, including amplifier, a diamp, using diodes as amplifiers and producing quite a bit of gain. Mike's making all kinds of interesting contacts with this. You should check out. He's got a new website. And I've got the link on the Solder Smoke page, so on the Solder Smoke blog, check that out. More inspiration. Somebody has started, and I think it's a great thing, something that I think had its start in the maker kind of hacker, in the positive sense of the word, world, and that's the rotating part box. And the idea is you take a box and you fill it up with electronic parts that you don't particularly need, and you mail it to somebody else who's interested in the hobby. I guess you'd have to know that they're interested in the hobby. It wouldn't do to just sort of randomly select people. Okay, but somebody you know who's involved in electronics, you send this box to them. And the idea is that they go through the box, take out anything they need, and then put in the box items that they don't need but that somebody else might want. And then they mail the box to, again, this is a really important point, mail the box to another radio electronic enthusiast. I think this is a great tradition. It gives new meaning to the word junk box, of course. And I've been watching reports about this on QRPL. And three cheers for the guys who got this going. And man, I'd like to get one of those boxes. Hint, hint. Finally, you know, before we go to Solder Smoke Mailbag, I want to do a movie review here. And this is one that you guys may be thinking about going to see. And I really wanted to go see it. Billy saw it twice in one weekend, once with some friends, and then the second time with Maria, Elisa, and I, and me. Avatar. You probably hear come some uncertainty in my voice here now. You know, I went to this movie with really high hopes. Maybe the hype was a little bit too intense, but I don't know. I didn't really like it that much. You know, I guess one of the reasons why, and this is why it's only getting 2.5 soldering irons. The rating that we're, this is the first time we're giving a movie rating, and I guess the best you could do is 5 soldering irons, and we're going to give Avatar 2.5. I don't know. You know, the hype was pretty intense. It was interesting to think about this new world called, you know, Pandora. And it was kind of cool to watch the technical gizmos that that our future space explorers will have. But, you know, the thing that got me, and I guess I'll make this more of a question than a review, but it was 3D. And they charge you a lot extra to watch it in 3D. And we went to a theater that was supposedly 3D. We went to one of the most well-known movie theaters here in Rome. We had the little glasses on and everything. And the film was obviously being presented in 3D format because you take the glasses off and you can see the kind of fuzzy images associated with 3D without the glasses. But, you know, we didn't just get any of those kind of jumping out of the screen kind of moments. We went to a lot of 3D movies in London and in Washington and in different theaters, IMAX and otherwise. And what really strikes you about those 3D movies is they have, you know, those moments where it really gets intensely 3D and something seems to kind of jump out of the screen and be right in front of you. And there was really none of that in Avatar. I did a little bit of Googling on this, and it seems that a lot depends on the size of the screen in the theater and whether it's IMAX or not and the aspect ratio and all this other stuff. But for us, the bottom line is we sat there for 3 hours with our little glasses on and didn't see a whole lot jumping out of the screen. I mean, it was hard for me to tell at some point whether it was 3D or not. So I wonder, what's the deal with the 3D in Avatar? Was I missing something, or is it just that way, or were my expectations too high? Anyway, 2.5 soldering irons, guys. I'm sorry. Sometimes we have to be tough here at Solder Smoke. You know what I'm talking about? Because our interest here is to protect you, the individual soldering radio amateur. Okay. all right, hold on now. Yeah, it's time for...
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
Hello.
Indeed. All right, Solder Smoke Mailbag. I'm missing a lot here, guys. There's just a lot of emails come in, and so if I miss something here, please forgive me. But Mike, WA6ARA, frequent listener and collaborator and contributor here to Solder Smoke, guy interested in many, many different things, wrote in, and sure enough, he's interested in radio-controlled airplanes, too, and sent me some really good piloting advice. It actually helped us, Mike, and it made one of our few successful flights successful, so thanks for that. And I printed out your message and put it in the radio control model airplane box, and I'll refer to it when we make our next attempt to get airborne. Thanks very much for that. Carl WM3E is into the podcast. He's reading Solder Smoke the book. He wants to get into Whisper. He's active. He's got a very nice situation, active on the air from a mobile home. Good to hear from you, Carl. Thanks for writing in. Mark, K5LXP, says that our sibilance problem is much better. Many listeners report that the whistling sound that comes out of my mouth has been greatly taken care of. What I did was I'm speaking kind of across the mic now. I'm not speaking directly into it. And also we're putting a pretty hard notch filter from 3 to 3.5 kilohertz. And when I do a little bit of post-production filtering here. So I think that has largely taken care of what another radio amateur, Paul AA6B, the way he put it was sibilance slashed significantly. I hope I didn't whistle a lot as I was saying it, but this I guess will be the test, and I'll just say it at kind of normal levels. Paul AA6B has noted that the sibilance has been slashed significantly on Solder Smoke. Thanks, Paul, and thanks, Mark. Mark also notes that he agrees Linux is not user friendly. Welcome to the curmudgeon club, Mark. We hear you. Got a nice email from a fellow in Ireland, Dave in Ireland, and he has been listening to Gene Shepherd, and he tells a really interesting story. He found some clips about Gene Shepherd's trip to Ireland, and he notes that he was amazed to find that Gene Shepherd had been to his hometown and had been in his pub. You know, in Ireland and England, Scotland, the pub is a really important place. And you could imagine Dave's amazement when he discovered that the great Gene Shepherd had actually been in his pub and had spoken about his pub, Dave's pub, in one of his radio broadcasts. So thanks for sharing that with us, Dave. Keep listening to Shep and keep listening to Solder Smoke. Good luck with your projects. Andy in the UK in Cheltenham reports that he has got a strange kind of variety of the knack. He calls it radio regression, and he seems to be doomed to work his way back from really complicated radios, little by little moving backwards in time and technology to simpler bits of gear. For example, he thinks he's moving back. He's starting out with software-defined radios, and he has been gradually moving back, and now he's playing around with crystal sets. thanks for sharing that with us, Andy. Keep us noted on your progress or regress, I guess. Let us know what's happening. I mentioned Paul AA6B, with sibilance slash significantly. Paul listens while on the exercise bike, so I'll just help you out here a little bit, Paul. Faster, Paul. Pedal faster. Raphael, KI6TJC, has the knack in San Diego. He's building Ramsey kits. Good for you, Raphael. Keep us posted. Let us know how those kits go. I always like the Ramsey kits. Alan, WA9IRS, points out that there's a really great article in EDN, I guess it's Electronic Design Notes. It's a really nice online publication. And the article is on the use of your nose as a troubleshooting tool. I think those of us who have released smoke from components know all about this, but the article that Alan points us to is a nice story about a guy who made a particularly good use of his sense of smell in figuring out what was wrong with a big, important piece of electronic gear. So thanks for sharing that with us, Alan. Mike, VK3XL, has really been a great help in trying to track down the mystery of the varactor-controlled direct conversion receiver that I tried and failed to build, that I tried to build and failed in getting to work back in the, I guess, in the early 1970s or mid-1970s. We're still looking for this article. Mike was kind enough to go out and dig up some articles from the 73 magazine archives, but unfortunately the quest is not over. We're still looking for this article, but thanks very much, Mike VK3XL, for the long distance assist. Stuart G3YSX also provides some radio control piloting advice, and Stuart, your message is also in my radio-controlled airplane toolbox. Thanks for sending that along. I'm sure you'll help us avoid some unfortunate encounters with the ground. Speaking of airplanes, oh man, this was one of the best emails that I've received in a long time. And guys, I get a lot of good ones. Jeff, N5ITU, wrote in and said that, you know, we have to be more technically precise when we talk about the knack and the Dilbert disease, because in these days of worrisome viruses, you know, when a new bug comes out, in the old days they just said, man, you got the flu. That was it. But now, of course, we have to know what variety of flu we have. And so we've all been worried about H1N1. Jeff has determined, well, at least has designated what the virus that causes the knack is. And it's not H1N1. He tells us that it's 72N73 virus. The Centers for Disease Control do not have this one in their books, gentlemen. Only we know about the dreaded 72N73 virus. And we have Jeff, N5ITU, to thank for this information. Jeff, thanks very much for the wonderful message. Jeff has this virus, guys, he's got it really, really bad. You know, part of it is, I guess, what we could call associated hobbies. You know, if you just are into radio, amateur radio, that's serious enough right there. But those of us who are deeply into it have sort of these kind of, I guess you could call, sidecar hobbies. You know, I've been talking about several of them here today. I've been talking about astronomy and the radio-controlled airplanes and probably several other things here in the course of the morning. Jeff has the sidecar hobbies too, but they're really serious. He's into warbirds. Ah, yes, you know what I'm talking about. Guys who get Air and Space Magazine, aviation enthusiasts. He's not out there flying these little Firebird Freedom styrofoam airplanes. No, no. Jeff is out there flying, building, working on, repairing the real thing. The real warbirds from World War II. Man. And I have a picture of him on the blog. I think he's standing next to an amazingly beautiful P-51 Mustang, if I'm not mistaken. Is that a P-51? Jeff, now, here's how serious it is, fellas. He's flying these airplanes, which can't be easy. These things are not really known as being very kind of easy to fly. He's got his headphones on because, you know, when you're flying one of these planes, you need to speak to other airplanes and the tower. I understand that's part of the process. But he has modified his headphones on the airplane so that in one ear he's listening to the control tower and other aircraft. In the other ear he's listening to solder smoke. Oh man, okay. Jeff also he did something else that I thought was another indication of extreme knack symptoms. He decided that to listen to solder smoke, he wanted to be able to listen to it anywhere in his house. So he rigged up a little FM broadcast band transmitter. I'm sure completely within the affected radiation power guidelines of the Federal Communications Commission, I'm sure, in compliance with Part 97 of the federal regulation, no doubt. And he set it up and hooked up his computer or his MP3 player to the transmitter, and then happily moved around his house doing his daily routine, listening to me drone on from here in Rome. Unbeknownst to Jeff, the frequency he selected was a bit too close to classic 88.9 FM, which a lady who lives near him apparently used to like to listen to, but now she's not listening to classic 89.3 FM. She's listening to Solder Smoke. So let's have a big shout out to Jeff's neighbor. Ma'am, we're very sorry. We didn't really pick the frequency. We hope that you're getting interested in this, and if you're interested in amateur radio, I'd like you to suggest that you buy my book, Solder Smoke the Book, available from Amazon.com. And please tell your other neighbors about it. Jeff, thanks for the broadcast boost there, and good luck with the Warbirds, and thanks for very much for identifying 72 and 73. We also, somebody else who's been putting out the word on Solder Smoke is Ross, K5SRT, and he's been spreading the word on Solder Smoke out there in Texas. He went to the Cowtown Ham Fest, was thinking about buying some regens or kits for regens or parts for regenerative receivers. Ross, stop. Don't do it. Don't do it. You may not have reached the episode in which I describe how regens are actually possessed and have diabolical characteristics, but, I guess you should go ahead. We all have to experience this ourselves, so go ahead and get the regen. Good luck with it. But remember, I warned you. All right, guys, speaking of Hamfest, that brings us close to the end of today's broadcast. We're a bit over time here, but been away for a while, so I don't mind going into a little bit of overtime. And I want to say something here to help you all out. You know, we're in the middle of the winter, but soon it'll be spring. I'm confident in saying that. You know, soon it'll be spring, and spring is usually Hamfest season, especially in the United States. Spring, summer comes around before everybody goes off on vacation, but when the weather's good, the Hamfests are coming up. You know, 4 days in May, Dayton, all of your favorite local Hamfests, all of these events. Guys, there's a question that I'm sure you're not asking yourselves, but perhaps you should. That question is, what will you wear? I know you're not asking yourselves that question, because I never ask myself that question. But, fellas, I'm in the T-shirt business, so I'm asking you to ask yourself that question. Wouldn't you like to parade through these Hamfests proudly proclaiming your interest in Solder Smoke, wearing T-shirts that say, with snappy and humorous phrases about our affliction with the knack, and about how bumper stickers that say that your other car was homebrewed from junk box parts, and how you'd rather be home drinking coffee and listening to Solder Smoke. All these things are available to you and could be part of your Hamfest wardrobe if you would just visit the Solder Smoke store at Cafe Press. You can get to it by clicking on the mug on the upper left-hand corner of the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. There's a lot of stuff there. T-shirts, hats. Hats are very important. Bumper stickers. Stickers that can be placed on other things other than bumpers are all there. All these things are available to you. The prices have been greatly reduced. And I hope that you'll visit this place, because if I don't sell some of this stuff soon, I'm going to have to shut the whole thing down, because they're charging me $6 a month to keep the website open. So here's how you can support Solder Smoke. Go visit the Cafe Press store. I have a bunch of other tips on how you could support the endeavor. It's down at the bottom. Scroll down to the bottom of the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page. Of course, consider the book. If you could talk up the book at the upcoming HamFest, that would be great. I'm going to come up with a little flyer. And if you guys are at HamFest, or you're going to be running a booth or something, or you're going to be selling your own stuff at a flea market, I'd ask you to print out a few copies of the flyer and to distribute it to folks as they come by so that they can learn about Solder Smoke and Solder Smoke the book. If anybody's interested in getting a few copies of the book to sell at your booth or at your flea market stand during the HamFest season, please let me know, and I'll make arrangements to get the book to you at a special price that'll make it worth your while. I think it'd be fun to get the book distributed that way. We might get bring some more people into this particular knack-oriented aspect of the hobby. All right, guys, that's it. Enough crass commercialism. Enough Luddite curmudgeonism. 7-3 from Rome.